Welcome back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, and today we are going to have a little bit of a different podcast. We have a guest podcast, and on the line I've got Steve Govett, president of the San Diego Seals, who is 4 weeks in to a new content project. Coach Govett, you have been prolific in quarantine, as not only have you created a podcast, but you've also created a cooking show. So first and foremost, my chef's hat off to you, sir.
I appreciate that. My cooking show is just on a slight hiatus because I relocated kitchens and I'm setting up a new kitchen as I move into a new place in San Diego. Very excited because it's high tech. I'm going high tech kitchen for the rest of Cooking with the Prez, which is probably going to change its name to TFL Kitchen, but you know what, whatever. But it's been a ton of fun. The project has been a blast. I'm so excited to do it. I've talked about it for a lot of years, about telling some old stories of the National Lacrosse League and the mill and, you know, the start of pro lacrosse and now's the time.
And so you mentioned TFL. It's also the name of the podcast. What does that stand for? What does it mean?
I'm not going to get into that, Terry, but, I got a lot of legends. They're total legends. You can figure out the rest.
So we're going to start by talking to the game's greatest, Gary and Paul Gate. You are also BC natives. You talk about what it's like to have grown up not on the island the way that those two did, but having hosted them. I believe it was called billeting is what Gary referred to it as. And so you used to play against those guys when they were young, right?
It's a very Canadian thing, billeting. So a couple times a year, the Saanich team that they played on and the Burnaby team that I played on, since we were about 6-7 years old, we'd go over to the island and we'd stay for a weekend, get there Friday night, stay Friday night, Saturday, go home Sunday, and we would be billeted. So we would stay at the homes of the respective other teams. And so you had a billet that you went to stay at their place and then they came back and stayed at your place. The funny thing was we always went to Playland in the Lower Mainland, which is like an amusement park, PNE, Pacific National Exhibition. And then whenever we went anywhere with them, we went to this racetrack in Victoria and we went to the races on Saturday night. So you played two games. You basically played a 1 hour game on Saturday morning and a 1 hour game on Sunday morning. And then you got on a ferry and went back. And really the highlight of your youth trip is to go play with these guys and host them. And then you just got to hang out. So I, you know, spent a lot of time with Gary and Paul Gates in the time that we were about 5 or 6 years old.
And so it's an appropriate kind of sample for our listeners to check out and get a sense for the TFL podcast. But also I know that you were trying to accomplish something pretty unique with this, which was basically just kind of change the tone, change the vibe of the typical podcast. I know I'm guilty of it, that haughty self-righteousness, taking yourself too seriously, and you wanted to swim upstream, right?
Well, I want it to be a little more like Jimmy Fallon, like, you know, more fun. Look, we're in serious times right now. And it's, you watch the news and it's depressing. And, you know, anything that you can do, you know, John Krasinski is doing the uplifting news or whatever that's called and good news for the day. And I just wanted to do something that where we could have a few laughs and get people that were personalities of our game. And the response has been overwhelming from the guests. Like anybody I've called has said, absolutely want to do it. So I've got some great ones coming up, John Tavares, Troy Cordingley. I've got great ones with my friends from the Wings, Mike French, Scott Gabrielson, Jimmy Rogers, three great coaches in the National Lacrosse League, and Derek Keenan, Eddie Como, and Paul Day, who have been around, the four of us have been around since the really early days. And some great stories, and people can sit around. I read something online, a tweet today that was pretty cool. Talked about, you know, I feel like when I listen to the TFL podcast and I'm sitting around a bar with a pitcher talking to a bunch of buddies about what the game used to be. And that's exactly what I think I wanted it to start out as. And it's rolling along.
So the limit on this podcast is pretty much how many friends you've got. So, yeah, I mean, as you said, I expect 6-7 more weeks of this podcast, and then it's going to come to an abrupt end.
Well, if it was based on the number of friends I had, it probably wouldn't have lasted more than 2 or 3 weeks. But the good news is these guys are humoring me. But there's a ton of guys. I mean, I want to talk to Petro about his career in the National Lacrosse League. Quint Kesenick, about his career in the National Lacrosse League. John Tillman, Chris Bates, Brian Volker, all these guys that you know from, you know, NCAA lacrosse, all played in the Major Indoor Lacrosse League. And there's a ton of guys, you know, Mark Millen, Dallas Elliott, Tom Marichek, all these, Jake Berge, all these really cool personalities that play, Pat McCabe. I mean, I could go on and on and on. Steve Kisslinger, all these guys that everybody's heard about, that they heard the legends. And now it's time to hear from the, from these guys, the stories that actually crafted a narrative around why the National Lacrosse League has lasted 35 years.
And that's a great segue into hearing from Gary and Paul, because, you know, I'm not a legend. You're sitting on that legendary status. Might as well turn the mic over to you. But wanted to make sure that listeners of the Inside Lacrosse podcast knew that the TFL podcast existed, because, you know, despite the fact that that Seals logo is front and center, appropriately so, given your role in the community, there's also, you know, this is really about the history of the NLL. And so, you know, for any lacrosse fan that either wants to learn more about the NLL or goes back to the early days 35 plus years ago, this is a great place to learn and hear, like you said, some of the sudsier stories of the league's, you know, impressive and illustrious history.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you saying that I'm not a legend, or that I am, but I'm not. And look, I want to have guys on that know the history. Listen, when Paul Gate in this podcast starts talking about how the Cascade helmet was invented, people are going to pay attention to the history of the game, not only from the National Lacrosse. If you're not an indoor guy, there's a ton of content about how people transition from indoor to outdoor, how people, you know, played the game. Paul Gate was a genius inventor. And it's so amazing to hear the story of how he invented the offset head. And it's just fascinating stuff.
Well, with that, we'll let you take it away.
Hey, everybody, I'm back. It's Steve Govan. I'm the host of the TFL podcast. This is episode 4, and pretty pumped about this particular episode. And one could say that I probably should have started with this episode, which I had always intended to do. But the good news is, hopefully I'm working out kinks on the first 3, but had a ton of fun with the other guys. But hopefully all of the lacrosse world and beyond recognize my 2 guests on this show, 2 longtime friends of mine. Probably I could tell you that my history in the National Lacrosse League doesn't even get off the ground if it's not for these 2 gentlemen. So Paul and Gary Gate, welcome to the TFL podcast.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us. It's always a pleasure to see your face.
Yeah, it is. Right. So the premise of the TFL podcast, as I've told a number of people, is to try and do something a little different and, you know, and talk about our history in not only the game, but in the mill as we started a long, long time ago. And then through the National Lacrosse League, and hopefully we get to share some pretty cool stories with a lot of people about the, you know, the early stages of the National Lacrosse League and all the iterations of what it's went through. But fellas, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having us.
So let's go back right to the very beginning of this, because I've heard the stories, and I've heard the Ron McNeil story, and you know, I've heard Dad, you know, the peppers and all that type of stuff. Tell me about who put a stick in your hand for the first time.
Steve, you might need to tell us. You know, we were only 4. I don't remember. I don't know, Gary, do you remember who put the stick in your hand?
No, that's too long ago. But I do remember the fact that it was, you know, Bob Pepper, neighbor, Greg and Grant Pepper, who Steve knows well, put his twin sons that were 3 houses down the street, 3 weeks younger than Paul and myself, into lacrosse at the age of 3. Because we terrorized the neighborhood, the 4 of us, 2 sets of identical twins, 3 houses apart, running around the neighborhood at 3 and 4 years old. Back then, the parents kind of just let us go, even at that age, because there wasn't much around us. So it was a chance to put the 4 of us in an organized sport. And so
The Peppers haven't grown since then. They're the same as they were then. I remember the Peppers. Lighter. Like the fact of the matter is they were two of the toughest guys you ever want to meet. But picture this, like you guys are from Victoria, Brentwood Bay, more specifically in British Columbia. That's where you grew up. You started playing in Saanich. And I was in Burnaby, which is on the mainland, right, in Vancouver. And so early on, you guys had a rivalry with pretty much every, you know, lower mainland-based team. But it was a really unique and dynamic because we kind of shared weekends together where we were kind of best friends during the day, and then we kicked the living crap out of each other. Paulie, how do you remember that whole process?
Well, you know, that's Canada, right? I mean, I can remember the earliest times when we billeted with Burnaby, you know, some of the early provincial tournaments and that. We would go over to Vancouver and we'd hook up with families from the opposing teams. And I don't know if I ever stayed at your place, but I don't think so. But I probably, you know, my teammates did.
Randy, we were drunk.
And that was part of it. So you became friends because you're staying at the kid's house, you know, and then you go out and you have to compete. So it starts early in Canada.
I do remember who put the stick in my hand the first time. And those NLL fans today would probably, they know Ben McIntosh and Garrett McIntosh. Yeah. Their grandmother was the first one to bring me into the game, and their dad and his brother, their uncle. So they were the first ones to put the stick in my hand. I think everybody in the lacrosse world regrets that at this point. So they may want to take it up with the McIntosh family.
Well, you know, you're lucky to have that memory. I really wish I could remember. You know, we were just so
dumb. You hit that way too much, Paulie.
So let's move on to the, you know, you guys obviously had an amazing career at Syracuse, and I've heard the story. So the one story that's probably never been told, and I don't know that we want to get into it here. It's been told one time as far as I remember it, and it was, Paul, when you went into the Canadian Lacrosse Hall of Fame and you brought everybody to tears, and this show is supposed to be funny, so I don't know if you want to tell it again. But you guys went to Syracuse and an amazing career, revolutionized the game, wore really short shorts and long spandex. And then you moved into the Major Indoor Lacrosse League where you got rid of the short shorts and just wore the spandex.
Yeah, it was easier. You didn't need the short shorts anymore. So we did go with the trend of the spandex under the shorts before the Major Indoor Lacrosse League. So we tried both, but
you had to have someplace to put the sock.
Yeah, the two pairs of shorts or whatever people wore back then, three pairs of tights. I remember some guys trying to bulk up in their spandex tights by wearing as many as they could. it was pretty funny. But, yeah, the story, you know, back, I went to Syracuse, but before we went, we wanted to take a gap year, as the Canadians and Europeans love to talk about a gap year. You know, it was an interesting part in our life where we graduated high school, and then suddenly, boom, our parents decide to get divorced. So they go on their own. So Paul and I both, you know, had this opportunity. Oh. Called me up in December of 2006. And, 1986. I'm hitting the head way too many times, too.
I've been hitting the head a lot.
So in 1986, I'm losing it, a call in December from Coach Simmons asking if I would come in January instead of taking the full gap year. And, you know, I said, look, I don't want to come by myself. You know, do you have that same opportunity for Paul right now? And Coach said, I only have room for one of you, the money for one. And I said, well, I'll just wait till you have the money for both of us. And we waited, and sure enough, the rules changed, things changed. It took another full year to get to Syracuse, and we ended up starting in January of 2007. I mean, 1997. Why am I stuck on the 2000s? I don't know. So 97.
It's a theme for today.
It is. So that's when it all started. We went to Syracuse in January, and it was a couple feet of snow, and it was there through April. And that was the beginning of a fun experience and a birth into the world of lacrosse in the U.S.
Paul, yeah. Have you seen that story the same way?
It's a lot less emotional when he tells it.
Yeah, it's very, emotionless. You were in tears. I was in tears when you told the story. Like, it
very
was
dramatic.
Very touching. Like, he just kind of, spends 10 seconds on it, and it's like, yeah, that's what we did.
Yeah.
Just another day for him, big time in my life, obviously.
Well, yeah, obviously. Yeah. Move on. You guys obviously graduated with a lot of accolades and won a lot of games at Syracuse, and there were some great battles there and set the stage for an amazing career, but for both of you. But talk about the first time you walk into the Detroit Turbos locker room.
Wow. Let me think about that. I mean, we spent most of the preseason up at Square Lake Track and Racket Center preparing, and as the early days of the NLL, you don't really get to see the arena until game night. So,
Paul, we practiced on a tennis court.
I know.
That's how we practiced.
Tennis court.
So that happened across the league. Like Baltimore did it. There was a ton of people. Like I remember when my first practice in Philadelphia was an indoor soccer center in Mickelson, New Jersey. And Gary, you and I made that drive a long time. Yeah. And Paulie was driving down from Syracuse because he lived there. And I'll talk about that in a second. But tell me about the Detroit Turbos. Like, obviously, that was a huge – it was big in Joe Louis Arena. And
this is a great story, Steve, but it has nothing to do with Detroit as far as it being our first game. Our first game was in Baltimore. So we'd begun our career with an away game in Baltimore. We hadn't even been in Joe Louis at that point. Yeah. We were at, Square Lake Racquet Club. So as far as our first experience in Detroit, that would come after a much better experience in game one. Talk about a league. This league had everything nailed. Gary and I were at a camp in Arizona for Mickey Miles Felton. So we were flying in from there. Our teammates were flying in from Toronto, and we were supposed to meet, during the early morning, get together, get organized, and play the game. Well, it just so happens, first opening night, there's a big snowstorm. All the flights are diverted away from Baltimore. So Gary and I end up flying into Washington, D.C., and we get there, what time was it, about 6:30? About an hour before the game was to start.
Yeah.
And then, the rest of the guys hadn't shown up yet. There was a few guys that were American local that got there, but the bulk of the team wasn't there yet. And they started straggling in. They all flew into D.C. and they caught cars. Well, some of them just weren't showing up. And two of them were our goalies. So first game, welcome to the pros. We've got a game about to start. We've got half a team. We've got no goalies. And the league is panicking. They're like, what do we do? We promoted the Gay Brothers. We promoted the game. We're in Baltimore. This is Lacrosse Central. We're trying to put on a good show.
People actually showed up in the storm, too. They didn't cancel it. Nothing. They were there.
So what do they decide to do? Well, the game must go on. In typical NLL fashion, it's happened a few times after that, but the game must go on. So they're asking everyone for solutions. And it turns out that our equipment manager was a goalie in Pee Wee. He's a little out of shape. He was a little older. He hadn't played goalie in, 20 years, but, it was the one thing we could think of to get the game played. So sure enough, they go to the minor league hockey teams. You guys have any goalie pads? So they don't even have lacrosse pads. So they found an upper body set of goalie, hockey goalie pads, a pair of hockey pants, and then they couldn't find any leg guards. They wouldn't let them use goalie leg guards because, one, that would look ridiculous. But so what they did was they took them, put them in sweatpants, and started shoving anything they could find down his sweatpants to make shin guards. So now our goalie is getting ready to start the game. A few more guys show up, still no goalie. So we're shorthanded. How many guys did we have, Gary?
Like nine. I think we had nine guys.
Nine guys and an equipment manager in net with sweatpants on. And we go ahead. Well, we go ahead and start, you know.
I got to be honest. I couldn't believe it started. We're both like, this is professional lacrosse. You got to wait for the players. You can't play without the players. We got an equipment manager that was like 45 years old, never played in 20, 25 years.
They had a TV deal then. It was on HTS. Russ and Chris had to get the game going because they had a TV deal.
Oh, my God. It was unbelievable. So we're like, all right, here we go. You know, we're playing against John Tucker and some great players. No, John, was he in Baltimore then, Paul?
They were one of
the better teams, and so it was the opening game, and oh my God, we played, and what was this halftime?
I think it was like 12-4 or something at halftime for them.
Like literally every shot they took went in. The only thing that saved us is when you get a situation like that, everybody wants to score, so they started shooting from like center. The guy's like, I got the ball. I'm shooting. I want to score. It could have been 20-4 if they had just taken better quality shots. But everybody said, this goalie's horrible. We shoot it on net. You're going to score.
So who won?
Oh, yeah, that's right. You know who won.
So we were down at half, and their goalie shows up, Ted Sawicki, the time all pro. You know, one of the few pure Canadian goalies in the league. And he shows up halftime, a van full of guys with our rest of our players. They quickly throw on their pads. We come out. We ended up winning, I think, 19-16. And we came back and won the first game. And it set the tone for the next 3 or 4 years. And you know, it wasn't the only crazy story. They had a game the year before, I think, where they played with hockey goalies. I think it was Detroit and Philly.
Well, wasn't it hockey goals?
Hockey goals.
There used to be one piece of turf that they transported around the league. And the one piece of turf with the goals was on the back of a truck, and the goals fell off. So when it showed up and they put the turf down, the goals were nowhere to be found.
Yeah.
And so they had to use something. So they used hockey goals. I think Dwight Mecke, the goalie for the Philadelphia Wings, was in the goal. And ultimately, they all thought the score was going to be crazy. And it actually didn't end up being that bad.
Yeah. And it was score.
Shooting from the outside again.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Now I think that would be a little bit different if you played with a hockey goal. But, you know, who knows? Hey, let's shift gears a little bit because obviously Detroit, was the start of your careers. And you guys, you know, Paul, you were living in Syracuse, and Gary, you moved on to Baltimore for business reasons that were, you know, lacrosse related. And your focus shifts kind of at that time in your lives from, you know, you're both playing, but your business lives shift. And Gary started coaching, and Paul, you started with manufacturing. And that's kind of evident today in where your paths has led you, but it's always kind of the touch point has always been in the game of lacrosse. But just talk to me a little bit about kind of where those careers kind of started to diverge and your interests started to go in different ways.
Well, I decided I got finished up at Syracuse and decided to move down to Baltimore. I had friends down there. And wanted to, I was working for STX Lacrosse, which was centered in, and Paul was as well at the time. And they were located down in Baltimore, and along with friends. And I thought it'd be a nice change from the Snow of Syracuse to go back. And I said, you know what? I'm not going back ever to Syracuse because it's too cold, amazingly. yes, it snowed yesterday, I believe. Moved down to Baltimore, got married, started a family, changed, got into coaching, got lucky with that and got an opportunity to coach at the University of Maryland on the women's side, got introduced to that. I had two lovely kids and kicked off. And Paul was in Syracuse. He was established. He stayed here with his wife. And Paul, we kind of worked together for a couple of years, even though we lived in Baltimore and Syracuse. We both represented SDX Lacrosse, and Paul went into to working for them. And then, Paul, you decided to make a move and go out on with a different company. Right?
Yeah, well, I had originally started with them in promotions and sales, and wanted to get into product development, product design. So, I hung in there with them for 3 years in the sales role, kept trying to get my foot in the door as a product development or product design guy. And at the end of the day, they went out and hired a really smart guy from MIT, rightfully so. So I knew that door was closing. So I figured I better leave SDX and start making moves if I want to be in manufacturing. So that's what I did. I quit SDX and went on to develop product for a baseball softball company out of Albany, New York, where I live today, which is why I live here.
I just want to point out, because I don't know that most of the people that are going to watch this, and who knows how many of those people there are, but at the end of the day, most of the product design developments that have hit the market in lacrosse can be traced back to you goofing off with a stick at some point in your past, or a helmet, by the way, because the current Cascade helmet was a... that story in and of itself is unbelievable, because it started out with you trying to play around with a rafting helmet, if I remember. And the current Cascade design, which is developed over a number of years, was really your baby early on. The offset head, which, I know Warrior had a patent on that. Maybe we can't talk about it legally. Who knows? But ultimately, you guys, when you bent your shafts, the cant on you guys were way ahead of the time on a lot of things, and ultimately has permeated throughout your career, to the extent that you could probably trace a number of the innovations in the game of lacrosse back to Paul Gate. But Gary, I'm right, right? Everything.
Absolutely.
Goes back to Paul Gate screwing around with a stick.
We both started young in that, like real young.
Isn't about you. You're supposed to talk about him. I am. We both did that.
We did.
It started young for Paulie. Paulie was a guy, he grew up in a cabin in the woods, and he had a wooden stick that he learned to rebuild, and he got into making his own pockets, making sure they were right, and he did it all. And then when we got to Syracuse, he conceptually came up with the idea of making equipment padding that actually fit together. It was amazing. At the time, the pads were designed as one unit, shoulder pads, kind of upper arm pads, everything all on one. And even in lacrosse before that, the shoulder pads and arm pads were all connected. And I just remember Paul saying, it'd be great if you could piece what you like about the pads together and not have everything all attached. So that was a concept I know that he took right to SDX when we started there and created the first set of rib pads, shoulder pads, arm pads that all fit together, and you could take pieces on and off to make it as protected as you wanted. So that was certainly one of the first innovations. And then, working on the issues with the offset head, and that ended up being a huge lawsuit that both of us were involved in. And it all started from the bent handles, and certainly not one of our original ideas, but growing up as kids, I remember Kevin Alexander, Ron McNeil, all these great old laxers from Canada that used to steam or curve their handle. And when the field sticks came out, the aluminum bend their handle to get the offset feel. And that's kind of how that all started. And that kind of blew up between STX, Brian LaCrosse, and eventually Warrior when they got involved in it. And Warrior ended up with the patent through all the lawsuits. I think they bought Brian what Brian had, and we battled through that. But that certainly, I think, can be linked back to Pauly and his creative ideas of why it worked. I think one of the things that Paul did well is he always explained, you know, why do we do this when we could do it this way and it'd be better? It made perfect sense.
You know? I wish you spent more time with the National Lacrosse League Board of Governors. Hey, Pauly. Tell me the helmet story.
Well, let me think. I was living in Syracuse. Cascade was based out of Syracuse. At the time, they were called Sport Helmets. And I had a relationship with the people that, you know, ran the company there. So when I was bored as a sales rep for STX, I'd stop in and we'd chat. And I was always taking their helmets apart and assembling different parts from different helmets to make my own. I always, well, you know, at the time when we finished school, the helmets were big. They were the big bubble helmets. So what I would do is I would go and get an interior foam pad out of a helmet that had very little offset and put it in the big bubble helmet so it seemed a lot smaller, you know, and change out, I think in college, like change out the face mask so you get the bigger eye openings on the old mask, and the new ones had smaller ones. So I always put an old mask on a new helmet because at the time the rules allowed that still. So I did that. So just through the process of trying to make the helmet I had to use better and knowing they were in Syracuse, I developed that relationship. And then one day I walk in and there's all these goofy little round helmets. And I'm like, what are these? They're all, we're getting into whitewater rafting. And if you've ever seen the whitewater rafting helmets, they're pretty goofy looking. And I'm like, well, you can certainly improve on the looks. You know, they're little, they're tiny, and they're round, you know. So as they developed, they brought in all the competitor samples. And I literally went through the box and picked out half a dozen, grabbed a face mask, which I had ordered direct from Cooper Softball. I think I actually sold those to a bunch of guys too, but a lot of the pro guys used them. So the Cooper Softball mask, I put on a whitewater rafting helmet. And I went through five or six of these helmets and I found one that I thought was good and it's nice. But in the meantime, they were still developing their product. So as I tried these helmets, I kept convincing them, you guys were onto something here. This is a great idea. Of course, they're all like, you're nuts. You're crazy. There's no way. And my teammates, they thought I was ridiculous. I mean, I don't know if, Steve, you were ever on a team or saw me in a game during that time. You know, you see a guy out there with the old round little helmet and face mask, you look a bit different.
Yeah, so, I mean, look, you guys wore Under Armour before anybody else because Kip gave it to you, right? I mean, you guys are wearing Under Armour. We all still have, from the 2006 championships, we all still have Under Armour sitting somewhere that with the giant UA logo that's now much cooler and sleeker than it was then. But, you know, the helmet was a big one because, I mean, obviously it changed the focus from a, you know, you try and explain to kids now when you coach, cut to the strings and they all look at you like you got four heads. Old guys will know that reference, but young guys don't, because you took a rafting helmet, put a mask on it, and revolutionized an entire industry. So pretty amazing stuff. Talk to me a little bit about your relationship with Tommy Marichek and why he's called Hollywood, because really that's the essence of the story. Is we all love the guy, but tell us why he's called Hollywood.
Hollywood, well, he's pretty.
He was always checking his hair, always making sure he looked good. There wasn't a mirror. I don't think I can remember for about 5 or 6 years him walking by a mirror without taking 30 seconds just to check out how he looked looked and how his hair was. Oh. And
windows, you name it.
Anything reflective.
Anything with a reflection. So after Detroit, you guys move on and go to – you're traded to Philadelphia. And the trade was a bit of a shim sham. And ultimately, first of all, the draft was a bit of a shim sham because the two greatest players in the history of the game end up on the same team is beyond me. And I don't get how that happened. But then you got traded. I don't know what you got traded for. We'll talk about Mike French in a little bit because he was the GM of the Wings at the time. But somehow he finagles a trade.
GM of the year.
Yeah, GM of the decade, I think. The greatest deal in the history of the game gets both Gary and Paul Gate to go play for the Philadelphia Wings. But just talk about that experience because that's where ultimately we came together and got to play together. We played against each other our entire youth career, minor career. You guys went to school, and then we came. I had the opportunity of two guys that had kicked the crap out of me and beat the shit out of me on the floor in junior for a number of years. I got to be on your side for a change. So talk a little bit about the Wings.
Well, let's talk about why we got traded, first of all. And it's a great NLL story. Second year in Detroit, Buffalo's first year, they bring on Buffalo as a new franchise. And Buffalo is killing it. They're getting big crowds. And about halfway through the season, they start selling out every game. Not that there's a lot of games, but they start selling out the games. Meanwhile, in Detroit, we were in first place. And at that point, we had already clinched a championship game berth because they were just going to take two best records and have a championship game. So us being in Detroit, having a good year, we had clinched. And now we were waiting to see who we were going to play.
You know who we were going to play? We were going to play New York.
That's right.
New York.
Yeah, right. So what happens is they go ahead and in the middle of the season change the playoff format. Obviously, yes. The Detroit.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, they went from the two division leaders playing in the championship game to a four-team format where because Philadelphia is finishing second in their division, which was with us in Detroit, and Buffalo's finishing second in their division behind New York, but Philadelphia and Buffalo have the largest attendance.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but at the time, there was only six teams in the league, so you had two divisions, right? Three and three.
Yeah, 3-3, six teams. So it goes to the fourth, so that to host the game at the time was, that final game was based on attendance. The team with the largest attendance got to host the championship game. So they go into this new format because they're going, oh, my God, we're walking away from the potential of a game or two with sellout crowds where we can make a bunch of money. In Buffalo and Philly. Well, the 1-2 teams both lost. The consolation was we're going to add two more teams. We're going to do a semifinal, but the two teams in first place get to host the semifinal with the hopes that one of the teams with the higher attendance would win. Well, sure enough, the number two team in each division upset the number one, and it ended up being Philadelphia, Buffalo in the championship, and Buffalo won the first. And it was their first championship. And there were also a lot of crazy rules, as you know, Steve, the number of Canadians allowed on a team. And all of a sudden they made a rule that Buffalo's a border team, so they could have unlimited Canadians, whereas a team down in Baltimore or Philly couldn't.
And the native players didn't count against the Canadian, no matter what border. They could cross the border without any problems. The native players were allowed to – they were non-Canadians, right?
So what it really comes down to is you got Russ Klein, Chris Fritz, two guys, start a league that are in the event business doing tractor pulls and monster trucks, and they're making up the rules with no sports in mind. They're thinking, how can we maximize to make this event so we can make some money? And it
did. The process destroyed the Detroit market.
Destroyed the Detroit market.
They had to trade you guys to one of the big markets.
That was exactly what they did. When we first went to Detroit, they saw it as an emerging market, and they saw some good attendance. So they put us both there with the idea of maybe we can sell out in Detroit and create this huge market here. And that didn't, you know, because they only had Philadelphia as a huge market at the time.
Right.
And then Buffalo came after Detroit and kind of replaced the idea of, well, we can't do it in Detroit. So then they said, well, Buffalo's already really good, so let's keep them together. They just won the championship. We'll move the gates to Philadelphia, the next big market. And Blockbuster trade, I think it was a bag of balls and a couple of extra goals or something that got traded for us. But magically we got there, and you know, the rules started changing, and players, you know, we were still weren't getting paid much, as you know, Steve. And you know, this is really where we get into the you know, one of Paul's greatest legacies to me is creating the National Lacrosse League.
Well, I told a story the other day, and I haven't told it a whole lot, but I do remember winning in 1994 in Buffalo, and we couldn't get the cup on the floor because they were raining quarters at us, but none of us would leave the floor because we were only making $83 a game, so we were all trying to pick up the quarters.
Something like that.
Yeah, don't jump ahead because, you know, when we got traded.
No, we're skipping that story.
No. Because let me tell you, I have one great memory from Philadelphia. And you know what it is, Steve.
We told that story already.
No, I haven't.
I know you haven't, but that somebody else did. It's
been on every episode.
It was such a great day for you. It was your first game in the NLL. I mean, you asked me that question. I'm just letting them know what your first game was like.
I do remember once I happened to, you know, and for those people that haven't heard it, I hit my head on the glass. Okay, that's the end of the story. But once I got up, I had some blood running down my face. And the first person I see is kind of the guy that had, you know, he wanted me on his line because he wanted me to get him open and help him set picks. And so Paul Gade is, you know, I'm excited because Paul had taken me aside and said, hey, look, you know, if you want to make it this league, get me open, I think is what he said.
So, I don't remember that.
So we ended up on the first line. We're supposed to start in the game. My favorite story of this whole thing is we're going to start in this game. I'm like, man, I'm starting my first game. I end up going to the locker room for 10 stitches. But before that, I get up and I look at you, and you just looked at me and went, go clean yourself up.
Yeah, so who has to throw their jersey away before the game even starts because of the blood rule?
I love the best part about that story is, well, wasn't your mom there or somebody, Steve? And they kept
Eileen, my wife's parents were there. She was my girlfriend at the time, and they were like, who is this fucking guy?
but well, wasn't somebody somebody looking for Steve? Steve, yeah. Where's Steve? He didn't play today. Did you play? Because you had a different jersey on.
I scored my first goal in the National Lacrosse League. I really need to talk to the stats people at the league about giving me one more goal because I scored it as Mark Gold.
That's right, Goldie.
And your poor family didn't even know. They asked after the game. Sorry, did you didn't play? Get to play, Steve.
That's a fact. That is a fact. So I do remember one of my, you know, and look, I'm a terrible host because we could spend 2 hours doing this, and I don't know how many people care, but we might care. But at the end of the day, one of the things I mostly remember about Gary playing for Philly was that he would show up with no stick, no strung stick, an empty head, some string, and a shirt that was always brand new, like in the plastic. And so I don't know if it was a theme, but he'd show up. He'd string the stick and warm up. And then after the game, he'd be like hanging the shirt in the shower so it would steam, get the wrinkles out. and ultimately wear to the post game. So never prepared, because normally he was just coming from a Maryland women's game directly to Philly to play, you know, a game. But I don't know, you guys talk a little bit about the travel that we used to do back in the day and some of all that fun stuff, because I tell you what, it wasn't an easy process.
It was not. And that's exactly, as a coach and trying to find flights to get from, you know, Blacksburg, Virginia, or some crazy places like that where you're playing college lacrosse, to find your way to Philadelphia. The good thing was most of the teams were in you know, in Long Island, New York, so you could fly into New York, Philadelphia, Buffalo. So they were decent places, primarily in the Northeast at the time. And yeah, you were literally hoping your equipment made it, hoping your gear made it, your clothes, everything. And you know, I got to the point where, you know, I had to string a new stick the day of the game, and all of a sudden I had a good game. So then it was a thing, like, let's string a stick before every game and start with a new stick. And it was kind of that whole idea of being able to replicate. And back in the day, that was tough to do, you know, traditional stringing, not mesh, and to try and get the stick so it was, you know, game ready, right, strung that day, you know. That was one of the things that, you know, I know Paul did it quite a bit, and he actually, you know, patented a machine that we still use today, or a similar type device that allows us to string all the sticks the same every time.
My favorite Paul Gates stringing story is I tricked him into coming out of retirement to play for the Colorado Mammoth for a year, which ultimately we all want to forget. Yeah. He wants to forget, but he pulled a stick out that he hadn't strung or he hadn't played with, and he's shooting with it in warm up, and the ball is literally going everywhere. And so me and the assistant GM and the head coach are just kind of sitting there looking at each other going, oh God, oh, this is not going to be good. Not going to be good. Yeah. He ended up being pretty good. Not bad.
Yeah. I do want to forget that round. The body wasn't capable or willing to step up and do its job.
I still had faith in you. I mean, we had some great times with the Washington Power. It was certainly a bit tenuous from a financial perspective, but that the rivalry, and for those that don't know, and Gary, I don't want to speak out of school, but ultimately we had to pay the rent one night at the US Air Arena or the Cap Center for the Washington Power. And Gary had to dig into his tax fund that he had saved for a number of months to pay his taxes to be able to pay the rent so we could open the building. So that was a time in our lives when we were literally growing the game one game at a time. And if it's not for the Washington Power, we don't have the Colorado Mammoth and the ultimate change in structure. And yeah, I mean, you guys were in Pittsburgh back in the day, and
I think
there's lots of stories.
There's lots of stories, but I think, you know, you miss a big opportunity here to talk about, you know, the formation of the NLL from the MILL and my recollection, you know, of the players battling with the two owners from Kansas City, and finally, you know, deciding to, you know, form a players association. And
so this is the summer of 1997, just to clarify, and the union had started in like 93-94.
Yeah,
it was the MILLPA, MILLPA, and then we go into a negotiating session or year in the summer of 97. So that's the birth of the NLL. Keep talking about that, because it's a really intriguing story from the start of the league perspective.
Yeah, I give 100% credit to Paul Gate for starting the NLL. You know, like, what happened, my recollection again was that Paul had met with a gentleman in Syracuse that owned the minor league hockey team, Howard Dolgan, was it?
Howard Dolgan. Yeah.
And he had a bunch of buddies that had owned other in Rochester, the minor league hockey team. And they had rallied four or five potential owners together that came to Paul and said, hey, we want to start a competing league. What do you think? Paul, maybe you could take it from here.
Yeah, well, what was it? Frank Duras, Steve Donner, Howard Dolgan, and I think one more I can't recall. But, yeah, I had started a business venture with Howard Dolgan. I opened a retail lacrosse store, and he was one of my investors in the business. So that's how I got to know him. But he ran a minor league hockey team in Syracuse, and he knew all the other hockey league owners. So, yeah, he's like, he was aggressive, and he wanted to compete, and he wanted to own a lacrosse team. And Chris and Russ didn't want outside people into their nice league that would seem to be working.
Well, that was a single entity ownership, right? So Russ and Chris owned all the teams in the league. And back to the story about the Detroit, Philadelphia playoffs, is they could make any decision they wanted to. And God bless them. Like, we all owe our entire professional lacrosse career to those guys, and we've acknowledged that a number of times. But this was a massive departure in that process. So, yeah, continue, Paul.
Yeah, the guys were, these guys were saying, we want to form a legitimate lacrosse league where you guys get paid, you have the ability to earn money, endorsements, et cetera. And to me, it sounded like a big step up. Get a professional league that's run by professional sports people. And I was all in. So now the battle is, how do we convince the Players Association to jump on? So I literally went around and called all of the top players from each team and signed them up for the new league. So that's...
Wait a second. You did?
Well,
I didn't get a call.
Well, I think I called Gary. You and Gary were playing together, right?
Yeah, I was rallying our side.
Yeah. Gary was – his job was to rally you. I think he did it. So you were in. But, yeah, so we got a bunch of players to sign. It created a weird situation, though, because quickly thereafter, Gary and I were signed by the league as – I don't know what our title was. We were player – I don't know what we were. But we worked for the league when it first started. So we could never be part of the Players Association because
it was just a Fugazi way to get you guys more money.
What it was it was their way. They offered that if I would go out and sign these players and get them on board. So that's what happened was we formed this relationship. They offered up future cash if I could get everyone on board. And part of the deal was,
sorry, go ahead.
Part of the deal was that I was playing in Rochester for that team, and I would be allowed to change teams when they changed the league. That was part of it because I had been playing on the road so long, and Dolgan wanted a team in Syracuse. So it was agreed by all the owners that, and when we signed on to help them develop this league, that I would be able to go to Syracuse, and Gary, you would be able to go to Baltimore.
That was the big request I wanted, was to be a free agent so I could go to the team that was closest to home, or to decrease the amount of travel, because we were doing midweek drives from Baltimore, God knows wherever you were, to the practice facility, like you talked about. You get home at 2-3 o'clock in the morning after practicing, get up, go to work, and do it again on the weekend for the game. So that free agency was what I really went after. And with the new league, it was all going to be great. We had 4 or 5 teams ready to go, but then Russ and Chris came around and they decided to merge the league. And that's when, things got a little gray and it got a little interesting, because all of a sudden, to make the deal happen between the new league and the MILL, they wanted to revoke what they promised to Paul and I. You remember that, Paul? Russ and Chris were like, we'll do the deal, but we're keeping the Gate Brothers on the teams that we own. So they merged, and Philadelphia and Buffalo stayed with the original MILL, and they wanted to keep us in Philadelphia. So, or Paul was in Rochester.
Right. Paul was in Rochester. Buffalo ended up, they were part of the deal because it was Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, and Boston. And then at the last minute, Boston kind of pulls out and doesn't play. Yeah. And Philadelphia, New York, and Baltimore continued, I think, and Rochester, or no. Anyway, whatever happened, happened, and ultimately you guys got the rights to go on. And, you know, Paulie goes to
what a mistake that was.
What a mistake that was. Gator goes to Baltimore.
Yeah.
And leaves the Wings and has, you know, an illustrious career with the Wings. And with the Thunder. And then they play there. We go to the championship in 98 in the very first best 2 out of 3 series. Philadelphia Wings play the Baltimore Thunder. But to talk a little bit before we move on, because we don't have a ton of time left. I mean, I guess it's a podcast we got all day, but at the end of the day, the first time you guys ever played against each other was the 95 final. It may have been an earlier game, but first time you guys play each other in a final, it is really the first time you've ever been on opposite teams, right?
Paul, I was trying to think about this. I couldn't remember for the life of me the first time we ever played against each other. You know, look at him.
Blank. I'm pretty sure it was that
scrimmage. Yeah. I do know it was before that season. We in 90, when I went to play for the Six Nation Chiefs and you stayed in Brooklyn.
Yes. That was the beginning.
That was it in Canada, I believe.
But that was a big game. The 97 champion, or sorry, the 95 championship was billed as this big game that you guys were playing against each other for the first time, at least in the pro league.
Yep.
And ultimately we win in overtime. And if you follow Dallas Elliott at all, you guys probably don't, but he shows all these games. And last night I literally clicked on a game that was like the next year in 96. Was the first time we'd played back after that champ, and they interviewed everybody that played in the championship game and what happened. They showed the highlights, and I remember it a little differently than what I actually saw on the screen. So I won't talk a whole lot.
That happens.
But all I remember was setting a pick on Reggie Thorpe, and Gary came off the pick and caught the ball and scored. So ultimately, in the years that I played, that's probably my crowning achievement is getting it in someone else's way.
There you go. Yeah, no, that was a heck of a game. That was back and forth. It was tight. And, you know, it came down to one goal and who got the last shot. I think Gary and I were both pretty hot that game. So it literally was who got the last shot. So Gary got the first shot in OT. So.
Oh, Steve, you'll love this. But, you know, that's when Paul left, you know. The gift that Paul gave me was a chance to play with Steve Govett, the guy that gets you open. So I remember he's like, I think Paul was chirping because I was doing well in the points or something. He goes, yeah, that's because you got Steve and all he does is get you open. If I had Steve, I would be doing a lot better too.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Well, my day. We can end now. So that thanks for coming to the TFL podcast.
Steve and I did a lot of work to figure out how to set a good pick and roll. I mean, we spent a solid 2 years at it.
We did. It was a lot of fun. I tell you what, though, I got to give a lot of credit to Dave Huntley, who, if you guys remember, Dave Huntley would chirp us all the time about how we cheated and how the Wings were cheating because we had this process and then we would set these picks that no one could defend. And everybody does it now, but, you know, it was certainly a fun time. I want to move on a little bit and talk just about you're in an NLL locker room. Who is the last guy, you know, who do you not want to sit next to in an NLL locker room? All right, moving on.
Yeah. You know what? For me, it was easy. I didn't want to sit beside Jamie Hanford. I got to be honest.
Funny, J. Jalbert said the same thing.
You know, he's walking around naked. He's, you know, in your face. I'm like, So I never sat near Jamie. So that was I was good with that.
Paulie, how about you?
Well, you know, Rodney Tapp, I think, would have to be my guy.
Oh,
you know,
oh, I got a
nobody
great
needs to see that. Nobody.
Oh my God. Tapper was, he was in the man grooming before it was a thing.
Yeah.
And he, I remember being in Victoria one time and Tapper's in there. It changed. I walk in and he's in the back shower area with his girlfriend and his girlfriend's trimming him, man grooming him. And I'm just like, what the hell is going on? It was unbelievable. But Rodney was a good one. He was a piece of work.
Well, I'm going to say a few names, and I want you guys to react to the names. But just your first reaction when I say the name Terry Bullen.
Old school.
Old school. For me, he was, you know, he was like a huge spider that, you know, he was an amazing defender, 6'5", something like that. Huge wingspan, and that was back in the league. Oh, that's not one word, is it? But anyway, he was tough to beat because that was back in the days when there was no such thing as holding. Holding was you could hold the guy, drag him down, but if the ball fell out of his stick, it wasn't a holding penalty. So that was the amazing holding rules of the early days.
Paulie, Terry Bullen.
Terry Bullen, you know, just a large, you know, it reminds me of old school because I think he played in Brooklyn, I believe, right?
Yeah, I played with him there, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, that whole team in Brooklyn when I played, they were all old. They were all old school. And Terry was part of that team, so that's what I think of when I think of Terry Bullen. He came from that old group in Brooklyn that I played one regular season game with, and we ended up winning the national championship. You know, so I played with the old guys, the old school guys. John.
Yeah. Well, now his daughter.
Go ahead.
Now his daughter's an All-American at Denver. Oh, okay. Great, great little player. Plays for Team Canada as well. So yeah, love the lineage there.
Dallas Elliott.
The cartoon man. No. Dallas was amazing. The greatest goalie I've ever played with. But he was always drawing his cartoons. I always, you know, loved to see what he was drawing next. He loved his Spider-Man. He loved his all his artwork. And I think he's done a bunch of projects over the years for the NLL and for the Wings you know, all-time great goalie, greatest ever legend.
Yeah, he was one of the last goalies. Him and Dwight, you know, they were one of the last two goalies that moved. You know, they moved around. They baited you. They left openings, and then they closed the gap. You know, the goalies aren't really like that nowadays. They're big, well, and they dress up, and they take up the net, you know. So, you know.
You guys probably never had to worry about this with Dallas, but – you know, he was a baiter, right? And he was the best at it. So, you know, I would always be trying to shoot for the spot that he was baiting me to shoot at. Some might call him a master baiter, but I could never hit the spot, so I'd always hit him in the head. You guys probably didn't hit him in the head. And to watch him go ballistic when you hit him in the head was something to watch. Anyway, tell me about Mark Millen.
He's one of the best Americans to play. You know, and he was one of those guys you hated playing against because he played with an attitude, you know, and you know, just got the job done, put the ball in the net, you know.
Well, yeah, athletic. I mean, I think when I think about him, I think about his turn. He had one of the best turns, the quickness, you know. He could break ankles when he was young, and that was his trademark, you know. Get you out of position by turning quick and going inside or going outside.
And great shot on the run, you know, like he'd be sweeping or come out of the corner and he could shoot while he's going full speed.
So a guy that you guys played with at the Cuse and ultimately played for the New York Saints for a while, Pat McCabe.
a legend for, you know, just all-time great defender. The best thing about him is he was the master of getting beat and making the trail check.
Yeah, I mean, he's a lot like Dallas. He would bait you. You know, you think you're open, you think you're going to get the shot off, and he would just wait for you to bring your stick back. He would put you in a spot where you think you're going to get a shot, knowing full well that he had the ability to take the ball away before you did.
So the next guy is, you know, obviously a legend in the news in the last couple weeks, but when I played my first game against him in indoor, he was playing for the Baltimore Thunder, and it was a preseason game, and he hit Paul from behind or on a breakaway, and it was kind of like one of those players that you know, he was a defenseless player, we call them now, and Paulie got smoked, and I think he put him in a coma. And Dave Petromala, who you guys had a long history with, yeah, in college and U.S. Team USA and Team Canada, and but talk about Dave Petromala's career as an indoor player.
He was a fierce competitor. You know, that's what he was. He hated to lose. He'd do whatever it took to win, and he was an amazing athlete, and he was a very good indoor player. You know, he was amazing. Could have played for a long time.
Yeah, he's a great. I mean, I go back to, you know, before indoor, I go back to, you know, championship games in college when he, Mark Gary, and, you know, that was the matchup, the greatest defender against the greatest, you know, offensive player. And when he came into indoor, that changed a little, but he wasn't quite as dominant as a defender in indoor, but he certainly was athletic and he was big and, you know, and he's a smart guy. Obviously, most guys that get into coaching are smart lacrosse players. He had a good sense for the game, and he picked up on the indoor game pretty quick.
I'm going to have Quint Kasnick on this show and talk a little bit about Quint's career as an indoor player, because he didn't play goalie, but he was at the front, you know, he was on the front lines of the games when Syracuse played Hopkins as a goaltender, and watched those matchups with you guys and Petro front hand, you know, firsthand. So I can't wait to talk to him about that, but talk about Quint as an indoor player.
Oh, I got to play with him, and he was a defender, super athletic, you know, your typical wrestler converted to lacrosse player, played goalie, but he was tenacious and, you know, wasn't the biggest guy, but he gave you everything he had. And that's, you know, that's why he had to be on the field, because he was relentless and went after and played tough D and got after the loose balls.
Yeah, full of energy. He played that way as a goalie too. You know, he's very active outside the cage, and, you know, he brought that over in the indoor when he was playing defense.
I think one of the things that I've started to do this and talk about players and look at players that played in the MILL and then ultimately into the NLL, is the laundry list of players that are now college head coaches that played in the Old Mill or the National Lacrosse League that probably at some point in their past, you know, playing indoor has influenced the way they teach the game and outdoor and have had success. John Tillman, Ricky Sewell, Dave Petromala, you know, the list goes on, you know, Chris Bates, Brian Volk. It's pretty amazing to look in the history of our league and realize the influence it's had on the NCAA.
Yeah, well, it was pro lacrosse. You know, the MILL was the only opportunity to play pro. So any guy coming out of college, you know, that was their shot. You know, let's go make some money. Let's play the best lacrosse. And, you know, so those guys that were in the game and as a coach and players, they wanted to play. And now that there's opportunities for those similar type players come out of college, and they go on and some of them make a decision just to play the outdoor game, and they don't try and play both. So the world's changed a little bit, but back in those old days, it was MILL or nothing.
So I want to move quickly on to two other guys, and I know both of them influenced our careers, one off the floor and one on the floor. But, Paulie, talk about Jimmy Rogers.
Jimmy Rogers. He was the man off the floor. I mean, he could start a party, and no matter where you went, he knew everyone. He knew how to get things going. He was an entertainer. A lot of fun.
A lot of good stories
around him.
The beauty of Jimmy Rogers, when I asked Jay Jalbert this same question, he says if Las Vegas was a person, it would be Jimmy
Rogers. Yes.
Talk about John Tavares.
JT, he's one of the greatest ever. You know, just amazing, you know. And I think both of us, or all of us, so fortunate to play against him. You know, he was the face of the Buffalo Bandits and still is. And he's done it all. He created that great championship culture down there, and he continues to do that. And, you know, I have nothing but high regard and respect for his talent and him as a person. Amazing.
So, Paulie, when you get, you know, all the shade because Gary, you know, his imposing figure is so large, and it's the Gary Gates Show and number 22, and you get forgotten in the whole mix. I get very upset about that. But, you know, when we talk about the GOAT in lacrosse, and the ultimate question for most NLLers and fans is Gary Gate or John Tavares. I know you have a hand in that discussion, but what do you say?
Well, it's a no-brainer for me. I mean, I played with John in indoor.
I agree, so we can move on.
I've got three good seasons with him, and one thing we learned was we probably shouldn't be on the same line. Yeah, but we came to terms with it. We were good after that. We needed two balls.
Yeah, no question.
Yeah. But, you know, Johnny had a great career, and his style was different. He was so smooth. You know, he played around the outside. He was tricky. He was a great feeder. He did it all in a different way. Not so physical. He was slick. You know, he could find holes. You know, create holes for himself, find holes, and really create a lot of great opportunities for himself that, you know, put him in a great spot to shine. And that's the way he played. And I think Gary went out and was a little different. He made opportunities. He didn't find them. You know what I mean? Like, he went out and created space and tried to work with his teammates to get the guys to play. And if that doesn't work, Gary was big, tough, and strong, and he could find a way to slice through the middle.
Yeah, and look, I say this all the time, and unfortunately, Paulie, I can't say this about you, but Gary was the greatest defensive player I ever played with in indoor, in box, and I think a lot of people don't know that, and you don't get credit for that, Gare, and I think it's worth noting when you do this, because I don't know how many other times we'll ever do this, but, you know, it's worth noting publicly that, you know, when you see The Last Dance right now with Michael Jordan and talking about his defensive ability, I think that gets lost in the mix. And if I was Dennis Rodman in the process with you as Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen, you know, I got to be Dennis Rodman in that mix. So
I like it. We just
green hair. At the end of the day, I think that you don't get any credit for your defensive abilities, and it was pretty amazing to watch you strip a ball from a guy. But I do want to change gears, and we're kind of getting close to the end, so I appreciate the time you guys have spent, and hopefully our listeners are staying with us, but they haven't all fallen asleep because they may be all over 70 years old. But anyway, the point I want to ask, what one actor would play both of you in a movie?
Joey would be one. In the old days, Paul used to get compared to Sylvester Stallone, the Sleepy Eyes back in the day. But Matt LeBlanc.
Oh, Joey.
Joey.
That's funny. How you doing? Paul, how about you? What one actor plays both of you in a movie?
Oh, God. I don't know if he's an actor. What about that guy that's on Diners, Drive-Ins, and
yeah. You can come on my cooking show. Hat. I have a cooking show. You can come on that and talk about it.
There you go. Hey, people would say that one a lot about Gary and I. I know, I get it.
The last one I want to talk about, and just, you know, we've been pretty serious most of the time here, so I don't want to change gears to be more serious, but if there's one story in lacrosse today that you're going to make a 30 for 34, and you guys get to pick the topic and commission a project to make the 30 for 30, what's that story? What story do you think deserves to be told in this world?
Well, I mean, I have one, but and it's the truth around the 1990 Syracuse National Championship team. You know, they've done a partial version of that, but at some point, you know, the full version of that would be interesting in the 30 for 30.
Yeah.
They told part of the story, right? Just to be clear, they told part of the story about where the trophy went, and but they didn't really get into the meat of the story.
No, they didn't get into the politics behind the scene, why it all happened. I mean, they briefed on some of it, but, you know, a university trying to protect its image and its credibility and sacrificing some of its own people to do so, you know, that's the story that wasn't told. You know, my poor coach, Roy Simmons, you know, his integrity was dragged through the mud, you know, not to mention the way I felt during that whole situation. You know, it didn't leave me with a good taste in my mouth about the athletic department at Syracuse. And I haven't said anything since then. And it's the reason I wasn't part of that story is I didn't want to badmouth Syracuse University, but there's certainly a lot that was not told in that story.
So we won't ask Gary to comment on that because he is gainfully employed by the
Yes, I am. That's awkward.
Walk away from that one right now.
But I will tell you, I think I had to meet with the attorneys before I did any interviews for that. It was amazing. They were still trying to deal with it, you know, 20 plus years later, figure it all out. But for me, I would love, you know, when you know, the NLL goes full time and it goes big time, which it is now, but when these players stop having jobs and it really goes to an NHL, NBA type level, I think you got to go back and tell the story of, you know, the beginning and how the NLL was formed. I think that would be a great 30 for 30. Because there's a lot of stories about the negotiations, players, you know, the John Tavares side, he sided with Russ and Chris, and the Paul side, and, you know, how we had a group of players on both sides and brought it all together, and, you know, and how, you know, it opened up the door. You know, Steve, that's how, you know, we partnered up, you know, and the NLL came along, and all of a sudden there was an opportunity to put together a new franchise or take an existing one and create the Washington Power. You know, that story in itself is another 30 for 30, you know.
That story is, ultimately, I've written some chapters of the book, but, you know, I'm inspired to write more in that book. But look, every person I've had on this show, I've asked what they would do for 30 for 30, and every story has been so interesting and compelling and ultimately digging deeper. One day our sport will be in a position where it's compelling enough and enough consumers out there will buy the property and buy the project. But I think I'd love to hear every one of these stories. I'd love to hear the 1990 Syracuse story. I think is remains intriguing with all these characters. And I think the beauty of the lacrosse in our world is that there's so many characters, and we probably could have gone on for another 2 hours if I just started riffing names. One of the names I forgot to riff, who's going to be a guest on this show in the not too distant future, is Mike French.
Frenchie.
We owe him a lot. All three of us owe him a lot from the perspective of, you know, the Philadelphia Wings and pro lacrosse and his heritage and pioneership through that process. And ultimately with Team Canada and he set the stage for a lot of things to happen. But Frenchie was a big, obviously, influence, making me a GM for the first time. Look, there's so many characters, and I think the characters of the Colorado Mammoth or the Baltimore Thunder, if anybody remembers, the Baltimore Thunder went to the Pittsburgh Crossfire, went to the Washington Power, and became the Colorado Mammoth. and still remains one of the original, you know, four franchises in this league, but is based in Colorado. And kind of, you know, we don't talk enough about kind of the formative years through the 2000s of the influence that you guys had in the game and ultimately on every player, including, you know, guys like John Tavares and John Grant and Casey Powell. And, you know, you guys were the heritage, your goats in my mind, greatest of all time. And I'll say that to John Tavares when he gets on the call as well. So, you know, you probably won't pay attention to that one, so I can do whatever I want. But anyway, look, I love you guys, and I appreciate you coming to talk for so long about of all things NLL and lacrosse related. I appreciate it, and it's been a blast.
Hey, Steve, we'll have to do it again down the road because there's a lot more stories to tell out there. A
lot of stories. Paulie, Uncle Paulie. We didn't tell the front row Paulie stories where he parked in the front row of every hotel and left the car there for 3 days. And no one ever towed it. I could never understand how he could get away with this. He always parked in the front row.
Yeah, you know, I've changed a little. I park way back now. I need the exercise.
Fellas, like I said, love you. Thank you. All right. We'll talk to you soon. And I appreciate you doing this.
Thanks, Steve.
Steve, thanks for having us. And I look forward to learning a new recipe soon.
All right. Thanks, fellas. Bye.